Thank you very much. Yeah, I'd like to talk about Higgs phenomenology today, in particular the region or the processes and cases where energy really pays off. We are now we have increased basically between run one and run two the energy by almost a factor of two. So this opens a certain regime that hasn't been exploited before. And of course, this will pay out and will pay off for Higgs phenomenology in the future runs. Run one itself was a very successful run for the LHC and for the high energy physics community as a whole. The overall situation as it presented itself after run one was basically this one, right? So we have discovered a new resonance. This is the Higgs boson itself. And with the Higgs boson, we have basically an object that was long thought for during previous decades, basically. However, now that we have found the Higgs boson itself, it is now our next task to infer what really UV scale and UV physics is realized in nature. So naturalness is basically our last and most promising guiding principle to infer what high scale UV completion basically could be realized in nature. To protect the Higgs boson from large radiative corrections, the mass of the Higgs boson, you basically have two different approaches. One is you protect it by a certain symmetry, you end up with supersymmetry, or you have basically a strongly coupled sector not too far away. So to say, a composite Higgs where potentially the Higgs boson is a pseudonumber Goldstone boson of this strongly coupled sector. To be agnostic, however, about UV physics, what we do these days and have discussed at great length over the shutdown period of the LHC is we parameterize our ignorance using effective field theory, the effective field theory framework, and basically set limits on the Wilson coefficients of these effective operators. However, in either case, if you have a symmetry and or you have composite sectors, what you usually have is scalar or fermionic top partners that then get encoded into simplified models. And what you in the end observe at a low scale, basically, in your detector is objects like jets, leptons, and missing energy. So this imprint of energy in your detector has to be traced back, has to be communicated between the high scale and the low scale. And this is an ongoing task for future measurements at the LHC. However, after run one, after the discovery of the Higgs boson, you could feel a certain hesitance in the HAP community. Somehow we had 2 years of shutdown, no data taking coming in, no new excitement news, exciting news. And so you basically could feel that high energy was to some degree suffering from the Big Mac blues. Basically, we were promised before the LHC was switched on new resonances, new symmetries. Everything would pop up when we switch on the LHC, but when we opened the box, when we unblinded data, what we got was only the Higgs boson, right? So, of course, the Higgs boson does its job, right? It unitarizes longitudinal gauge boson scattering, renders a theory well-defined to high scales. On the other hand, however, it does it in an aesthetically, say, unpleasing way.
But were data ever blinded? I don't think they were blind switches.
No, sure. I mean, this is just, you open the box, basically, you look at the data, and you have a look, and you basically see that what you got is the Higgs boson and nothing else. So, basically, this tension between reality and what was advertised before, to some degree, was pushing back on the overall mood in the community. This might now have changed, of course, since we have a new access, but we also have to make ourselves aware of what the Higgs boson actually is. It's only a leftover. It's only a remnant of a glorious symmetry-breaking mechanism, the broad-angled Higgs mechanism. So what we actually did was only finding this byproduct, this leftover of this mechanism, by looking into a very messy environment, basically by digging through the trash bin of the UV theory, finding that we are on the right track, the Higgs boson is there. But of course, we don't have a detailed understanding about what actually triggers electroweak symmetry breaking or how it is really implemented and in nature. So Of course, there are other observations in nature that have to be explained, that lack explaining in the standard model. And potentially with the new diphoton excess, we might go into the right direction and maybe find something else to look for. However, this tensioning between measured data and theory is an ongoing task, is an ongoing challenge that has to be addressed in future runs, irrespective of Higgs phenomenology. And therefore, what we came up with, now focusing directly on Higgs phenomenology, was a different frameworks to address and connect UV physics with measurements. So during run one, a very successful framework was the so-called kappa framework. This just means you take the standard model couplings and you rescale them. You allow maybe for an invisible decay mode as well. This is the kappa framework. As a result, you don't induce kinematic shape difference, right? It's an overall rescaling of the differential distributions, a global rescaling over the PT range, but you don't induce tilts or so on in the no further Lorentz structures are induced and no further kinematics. This was then extended with a huge effort to the EFT framework, effective field theory framework. This basically allows you to get new Lorentz structures that are consistent with your gauge group and particle content. And therefore, you could simulate basically kinematic features that would be induced by new degrees of freedom at a higher scale. However, of course, you have to be careful because you have to be able to integrate out these degrees of freedom. So the range of your EFT was also to some degree limited. Now, to incorporate light degrees of freedom, simplified models were proposed and were followed up quite a lot. And then, of course, there are always full models. Basically, you can, of course, have a look at the full MSSM and tension some parameter point directly with measurements and data. So basically, these four different frameworks were deployed to experimentalists and used in giving an interpretation of LHC data. Of course, the complexity rises, right? The number of degree of free parameters increases here from left to right. So first, have a look at the kappa framework. It's really just an overall rescaling of the coupling. In the end, you only look at two separately when you do the fits, when you do tension data in a global fit with the theory prediction. It's just the production cross-section of the resonance. The resonance has to decay, so times the branching ratio of the resonance. So you have two couplings, the production coupling and the decay coupling. And in the denominator, you constantly have the total width. So this ratio is just the branching ratio. A lot of groups have done these fits. And as I said, this is only taking into account total rates, basically. However, now moving on to an EFT framework, if you set up an EFT framework, you have to address basically four fundamental issues or four fundamental questions to answer in your EFT language. First of all, you have to have a basis of your operators, and this basis better be complete. The question, however, then is, does it have to be inspired by UV physics or not? This is ongoing discussions. And then if you have a full basis, a complete basis, the question is, how practical is it to constrain, to limit these operators? Is the number of operators manageable within this, within your theory? The validity is an issue. Of course, you have to be allowed to use the language. The EFT is only a language. It only is a language to basically transport information from a low scale to high scale physics, where you then do a matching calculation between the UV theory and your limits you got for your Wilson coefficients from the low scale experiments. And the other question is then precision. How precise do we have to be in calculating actually the Wilson coefficients? Do we have to include RGE improved perturbation theory or even do a full next to leading auto calculation for these processes? Now, I will briefly just address all these four issues because they have been vividly discussed during the last 2 years before the LHC of Run 2 started. So first of all, if we have a standard model particle content and gauge group, agnostically, you have 2,499 non-redundant operators. That's, of course, a huge number, right? You will never be able to over-constrain the system of operators with LHC measurements. So if you, however, then use a flavor diagonal approach, so you reduce the flavor violating operators in this approach, since they might have been limited fairly strongly from low energy measurements, flavor measurements in this sense, so then you are left with 59 operators. Still an unmanageable amount of operators here. However, since the Higgs boson is the new kid on the block, and we want to basically use the...
59, this is when you impose MFB or something like this, or you
throw away...
Or you throw away the
the flavor violating operators. Yeah.
Which is means MFV or?
Yeah, which kind of, I mean, MFV also allows you to have non-diagonal flavor contributions, right? So it's even more radical. So basically, you have no diagonal flavor contributions. And MFV, in a sense, the cover coupling hierarchy is not taken into account here. You still have diagonal contributions to H to BB bar, basically, that could violate the hierarchy between top and B. So you are free in varying the Higgs to BB bar coupling, but Higgs to char, it's not the basis is the same. It's just a certain assumption on the Wilson coefficient. Some are set to zero, basically. So then.
So just to make sure I understood, so the statement of diagonal is not that, so if I have something like a top, charm, they all have the same coefficient, or as long as it's not mixing flavors, you give it a random coefficient and then it's got an argument.
Yeah, you set them to zero, basically. You don't have a DK Higgs to charm strange, for example.
So I understand that you don't have things that mix flavors, yeah. But the things that are diagonal in flavor but involve different flavors, they can have different normalizations?
Yeah, they can have different Wilson coefficients. Yes. Okay, since the Higgs boson is the new kid on the block, basically, and we have already limited a lot of these operators at LEP, namely the ones that basically directly contribute to the width of the Z boson or all STU parameters and these kind of things, of leak corrections and so on. These are already constrained at the per mil level from lab physics, and therefore we cannot expect LHC to do better in limiting these operators. So basically, these are also assumed to be zero and not taken into account for the fits at the LHC. If you do this, then finally you achieve a manageable amount of operators you can actually limit. So you're basically down to something 8 to 10 operators. This is now presented here in the Silch basis in a strongly interacting light Higgs basis. And all these kind of operators, of course, can be now constrained in a global fit at the LHC. To over-constrain the system, of course, you want to look into as many channels to produce the Higgs boson, and into as many channels as you have to where the Higgs boson can be observed in its decays. So Higgs to gamma-gamma, Higgs to z-gamma, and so on, Van Gluon fusion, HV, so Higgs-associated production, TTH, boson fusion, and so on. And of course, since these operators are momentum dependent, at least most of them are momentum dependent, they would probably show up for large momentum transfer. They would be enhanced for large momentum transfer. So you actually want to look into the tails of the differential distributions to set the most tight limits on these operators. However, when using EFT as a language, we always have to make ourselves aware what this actually means to set a limit on a Wilson coefficient. Basically, what we limit is just this ratio here, the coupling that is inspired by the UV completion divided by the new physics scale. And the new physics, and the interesting part is basically, if you do these measurements at the LHC, it's very different to, for example, measurements at B factories. Because at the LHC, what you actually do is you basically have a measurement, you can think of it as the black line here, and then you have a hypothesis test. So in general, basically different Wilson coefficients, your tail of your distribution could go up or down, depending on the Wilson coefficient itself. And of course, the limit you get because of observing or not observing the deviation of the red line, for example, with respect to the measurement of the black line, when you actually compare your theory with the measured result from an experiment, results in this diagonal here on this two-dimensional plane. The vertical part is the coupling, the horizontal part is a new physics scale. So since you constrain this ratio, in the end you get a diagonal here. On the other hand, you also know that there was no bump, there was no new physics up to a high scale to which you probe your operators as well. So the transverse momentum of your Higgs boson has been probed here, for example, to 800 GeV. This means you get a vertical axis as well here, because you are not allowed to use the EFT framework for models that are living actually below this cutoff scale. So in the end, when you do this limit setting procedure, you have to ask yourself, how many full models are actually living up there? How many models allow you to be limited by this precise measurement? There's a huge discussion at the moment between in the Higgs, but also in the dark matter sector, where people argue you are not allowed to use the EFT, it violates validity and so on. There would also be a horizontal line, actually, if the coupling becomes non-perturbative, because then, in the end, you would not be allowed to truncate after dimension six operators. So it's not so clear if you at what level of operators you would truncate at this point. So actually, the important part is here, which kind of weakly coupled models can be accommodated in this green area up there. And of course, this part here would also be valid for EFT, but here you don't have sensitivity. If you, for example, could reduce uncertainties here, you could basically tilt the diagonal line here to a smaller gradient. Okay, this is basically the question to ask. The EFT itself is just there for a means of transporting information from a low scale to the high scale physics. Now, the crucial difference at the LHC compared to beam dumping, to flavor physics is in flavor physics, when you have, for example, the beam meson decaying, this always occurs at the same scale. It's basically the beam meson mass. So this is your characteristic scale of your process. And in flavor physics, you have the ratio where you have the electroweak scale, the electroweak particles being integrated out at something like the W mass, and the ratio to the B bottom mass or B meson mass is roughly of the order of 20. At the LHC, you probe similar hierarchies. The Higgs mass has something like 125 GeV. The end of your PT distribution can go out to 2 TeV, so you roughly have the same ratio of scales. Therefore, potentially, you could think of as having in the Higgs sector an equal need for higher oil corrections, RGE improved perturbation theory as for flavor physics. The difference to some degree is here it's very often electroweak couplings, whereas in flavor physics, often strong couplings come into play.
And you're kind of probing down into the strong interaction region to get down to MB, right? It's, I would have thought that what's less important than the ratio of scales is that in the flavor case, the lower end, you're getting down towards QCD scales, so you're starting to care about this. The coupling's not so small, right?
That's right. So this is a different, this is the other part, right? You go to the non-perturbative part, basically, where you have the Wilson coefficient and the matrix element basically separated, right? And you basically shift between these two when you go to the lower scale. You say maybe down to close to lambda QCD or something like that, right?
But you're saying when these people do these summations in these higher energy applications, they get similarly large effects.
This is not what I'm saying. So basically you could expect that there is a large separation of scales and therefore it could be important. So the crucial difference here, however, is at the LHC that you actually probe for each individual event a different admixture of operators. You probe for each individual event you measure a different characteristic energy scale. And this is very, very different to flavor physics, where you basically have one characteristic energy scale, the B meson mass. However, here, each individual data point corresponds to a different admixture of operators. Under RGE flow, they can mix, they can run, and therefore the operator you limit for one bin entry here would have a different admixture. So basically, you would have to be consistent. You would have to evolve them for each individual bin content up to the high energy scale, where you have defined your operators, and set a limit there. The other thing is the scale is here. So if you assume that your new physics lives just behind the measured endpoint, then the running is not very large anymore, right? Because you already probe the tail of the distribution. This is where you get your large sensitivity from. However, then only a factor of two or something like that is present for the uprunning to the new physics scale where your operators are actually defined. So then the running is not that important anymore for differential distributions. This was all a little bit different for lab physics. This was all a little bit different for flavor physics by itself. At the LHC, these kinematic effects are very much underappreciated in the community. Because basically what we did was adopt the whole approach from flavor physics, right? It has been established there for decades already. We basically don't do anything new here. The whole framework is obvious and clear to some degree to take over. However, these effects are new and therefore to some degree underappreciated. Now what you can have is, if you take this correctly into account, the effects are generically small, 10% or less or something like this. Therefore, this is fairly safe. But what you can have, for example, is T parameter violation. in doesn't work here. T-parameter violation at the high scale, for example, T0 at the low scale, which would agree with observation. These kind of things can happen, and this is basically the train of thought. Now,
T, meaning,
T is the correction to the row. Exactly, the correction to the row parameter. So, so what we did is we simply implemented a global fit for this. So this is the first consistent EFT consistent global fit for the Higgs using the full set of 7 and 8 TeV data in all available channels, and we project what you can actually do at the 14 TeV LHC with 300 and 3000 inverse femtobar. Now, we try to be consistent in the EFT approach, so we only take the linear part of the dimension 6 contribution here as a correction to the standard model contribution. And as you can see here, we basically use all kinds of production mechanism and decay mechanism. This is here the theoretical uncertainty. We keep the theoretical uncertainty flat. Obviously, the theoretical uncertainties will improve over time, but to be conservative, we keep them flat. Where we are not necessarily a conservative is that we keep them flat not over integrated luminosity, but also over PT. So the tail of our distributions have the same theoretical uncertainty as the total rate, basically. This would not be very realistic because you get large logs in the tails, and therefore these would have to be resummed and so on. So there's a larger level of uncertainty in the tails, but nobody really has a good idea of the functional dependence of the theoretical uncertainties in these highly exclusive phase space regions. Okay, so then what you do is basically you predict the number of events for each individual channel. You have to take into account reconstruction efficiencies for certain production modes. It's easier to reconstruct Higgs plus Z than, for example, gluon fusion, where you only have one scalar resonance. It's easier to, you also have efficiencies in the decay. It's easier to reconstruct Higgs to gamma gamma than Higgs to BB bar. And these of things have, of course, been evaluated experimentally, and they are taken into account in this global fit here as well. What we use as a differential observable is the transverse momentum of the Higgs boson itself. You want an observable that is highly correlated with the characteristic energy scale where you probe your operators. And the transverse momentum of the Higgs boson is actually highly correlated. So this is basically our differential distribution, which we hope the LHC experiments will measure in the upcoming runs. They have provided one measurement for 7 and 8 TeV, which was Higgs to gamma gamma. There you have basically already a transverse momentum distribution for the Higgs boson, and you could take this here into account as well. Then you generate pseudo data for different channels, which looks like this. So you have different PT bins for the Higgs boson, basically 100, 0 to 100, up to 500 for TTH, VBF, and so on. This is just a very small number of our channels we consider. It's hundreds of channel. We have a look here. And it's of the order of 600 bins we take into account here for this global fit. So it's a huge effort, and it takes a long time to evaluate these things. And what you come up in the end with is, this is now here a two-dimensional limit setting for basically two of these operators. So ZG would, for example, be the Wilson coefficient for the Higgs glue, or H dagger H, G mu nu operator. Then, for example, CH would be the contribution to the kinetic term of the Higgs boson. C gamma gamma, or C gamma would be the Wilson coefficient for H dagger H, F mu nu. So you have these kind of operators, and the gray area here, the dark gray area, is 66% confidence level at 7 and 8 TeV. And as you can see here, it's very badly limited. If you go to really 14 TeV with 3000 inverse femtobarn, you suddenly start to get rid of blind directions here. You basically get fairly narrow regions, and you can set a limit to these operators. So the story is basically that the differential distributions, they buy you a huge amount of information at the LHC. You have more bins. Each bin is treated as a separate measurement in this limit setting approach, and the tails of the distribution, they go up unproportionally compared to the total rate because of the large momentum dependence of your effective operators. So suddenly, you get a very good sensitivity for a lot of these operators. And here is the overall overview. We marginalize always over the other operators, right? So we basically set a limit on this one, and we marginalize within the allowed range of the other operators. This left one just shows signal strength measurements. Blue one is 7-8 TeV. Then green one is 14 TeV with 300 inverse femtobarn, and the orange one is 14 TeV with 3,000 inverse femtobarn. And now, including differential distributions, and you can see that the coupling strength, that the measurements here improve tremendously with including these differential distributions. However, what you want to do in the end is, since this is only a means of transportation for information, you want to match it up to a high-scale theory. For example, composite Higgs model, and since we have used the Silge basis, we can read out the Wilson coefficient here directly and relate this to the composite Higgs operator. So what you find then in the end, using the prediction for our 14 TeV, 3,000 inverse femtobarn result, is that you can set a limit indirectly without observing anything else on the compositeness scale of 2.8 TeV. And of course, you can do the same, for example, for the MSSM using the CG Wilson coefficient. And then you get, of course, here in this two-dimensional plot where you have AT buried and the soft mass, the spark mass, basically, between 500 to 1,500 GeV. You get regions that are being constrained and others that are not. So you basically can infer on your UV model directly from these limits of your Wilson coefficient. Both experiments are in the... Yeah, this is exactly. So this is the... So I identify here M with the right-handed one and the left-handed one.
Would they direct searches be in those
sense? Of course. This is always true. But direct searches, you have these loopholes, right? Basically degenerate mass spectra and all these kind of things. This is here an indirect measurement where you basically can exclude these kind of contributions by measuring precision properties of the Higgs boson itself. So it's absolutely true also here in the upper part, of course, direct searches would be at some point more sensitive, no question. If the spectrum is nice and cozy and you see these resonances and you have large separations of resonances in mass, then you will get nice, clean, fairly clean signatures at the LHC. However, this is done in a model-independent way, in an indirect way.
So before you do this, you're being very careful to tell us the basis, and I know that this is part of the controversial story.
Yeah.
So is there? But I don't really understand what the controversy is. So what exactly is the issue that people are worried about?
There are lots of issues because, yeah, so there are four different bases. So
why do I need to know what the basis is? Because it seems like physics won't care at some level, right?
Yeah, some people say that the basis in that the lepton sector is not closed, basically. So you can... But for this approach, it doesn't matter because the operators we are constraining here, they are basically closed as a subset. So with these assumptions,
what does closed open mean?
I mean, you make a certain assumption. You limit yourself on these eight operators.
Yeah.
You can, of course, redefine these operators in a different basis set. You can rotate them into each other.
Yeah.
And of course, people have even used or have developed tools like. Rosetta, which does this automatically for you. So you basically give your Wilson coefficients and in a certain basis, it pops out in the other basis. These kind of things, as soon as there was agreement on the number of operators, so 59 operators, for example, in the original paper or in the old paper by Buchmüller and Wheeler, this was not a non-redundant basis. So they had something like 78 or something, I don't know exactly, something like that. So you could reduce this. As if they agree on a basis, then it's fine and the basis is complete. There's, however, a huge controversy if next-to-leading order corrections are actually needed. Another controversy is, do we need to take into account the square terms here? For example, so here basically at this part, the terms that come with lambda to the power of 4. So basically the MD6 squared terms. So this is the next term in the expansion. The question, however, is if the new physics is actually as strongly coupled as the standard model, or even stronger coupled than the standard model, these cannot be neglected anymore. And it also would be not formally correct to recast such an analysis for these contributions if the new physics scale was really strongly coupled in a sense. But people agree that you should have a look at this on a case-by-case basis if you want to do a matching calculation, if you want to trace back to the to your V theory that is actually fairly strongly coupled, then potentially you have to do a different fit here. But usually for weakly coupled scenarios, this is actually the right approach and so on. So these kind of things are being discussed.
So to make sure I understood, so the basis issue, people are not agreeing on, people do agree on the total number of operators that are needed, and
yes.
Then it's just a question of, but then it's just a convenience issue as to how you organize
Of course. I think this is fine. This was in the beginning a bit of a heated discussion, but I think this settled down to some degree.
I thought that there were some discussions on the, like, the certain operators have to come up with a certain sign.
Yeah, this is the next thing, yeah, of course.
And that for UV consistent theory, it has to do that, I've got terms of extra derivatives have positive or something like that.
And so, but I understood that was a, so in the end of the day, how did that shake up? I remember there was a controversy there. was it inside it, or what's
the Wilson coefficients can be, for example, inspired by UV theory. Some can be small, some can be large, and you can make this assumption in the beginning basically already.
Yeah.
And then, of course, others say, I mean, this is not a completely agnostic approach, and it might not work well for other theories, so it's not a very complete approach to the whole thing. What's being done here is we limit ourselves here to 8-9 operators, which are really the dominant one that have freedom, and we have no assumption on the Wilson coefficient, so we vary this within its range. So this is not a problem here. Only if you make a certain assumption on the UV physics, get rid basically of some of the lower scale operators by making assumption on the UV physics, then of course you can have an incomplete fit, let's say, or a fit that doesn't work in an agnostic way. Yeah.
So the question came because you were careful to say which basis you used, and I wasn't sure why you needed to know.
I'm sorry, this is not good.
So you were careful in one of your slides to say that you're using one of the bases, and I wasn't sure why we needed to know.
This is just a choice. If I present these operators in this basis, then I get a result in this basis, but in another basis, the numbers would be different, right?
It's, so that means the numbers themselves are not so informative. It's really the collection of the numbers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so this search people that would vary some coefficients from zero to positive rather than from well minus to positive.
All right.
Question about this, shaded regions, is this what this will be with 14 TV?
This is all 14 TV, 3000 euros femtobarn. Yeah. Now a different playground for EFTs is cosmology, and you are exposed here to a lot of cosmology talks, I'm assuming. So if you recently these Sondesky theories, where you basically couple one single scalar field with a second order equation of motion to gravity, have to address the dark energy problem, have been very popular. If you do this, if you limit yourself to these kind of theories, for example, and you know that the most general metric, according to Bekenstein, that respects causality and the weak equivalence principle has to look like this. And if you then put this in, you get basically two leading order operators, the conformal one, we have the trace of the energy momentum tensor, and the disformal one. And this is actually quite nice because the lowest order operators are here already dimension 8. And higher order operators can be dimension 12 and so on. This is a kind of dimensions that are unheard of basically in particle phenomenology.
And so, phi is masses?
Yeah, so we put a small mass, but the mass for the limits we set is completely irrelevant. You can it doesn't matter. So then there are also kinetic terms, so you can see this is a highly, highly complex set of operators. Galilean models fall into this class, and so on. And basically, you have some with shift symmetry protected, and some with a broken shift symmetry.
I have to ask now. So you said Galilean models fall in this class, but Galilean models have a cutoff which is below the millivolt. How do you apply that to LHC?
No, this is exactly the point. But I think so. This is, I think, what I wanted to show here in this diagonal. You set a limit to the Wilson coefficient. The cutoff scale.
Your lambda and GEE, but their lambda is like less than 1 eV.
No, no. The what you say is you limit, you set the cupping here to 1. Then your new physics scale is the denominator. Then you find a limit on the whole Wilson coefficient of a few eV or whatever you find, let's say a few MeV.
Small MeV, right?
Not yeah, and so you are right. It could be that, for example, there's no model that actually falls into the limits, and there's no UV model. But coming up for UV model for gravity is anyway not that easy.
We're not talking about UV model and quantizing gravity. We're talking about the LHC is the UV model.
I understand, absolutely. Yeah. So this is exactly true. The point is, the question is where you set your vertical line here and where you set your diagonal here.
Well, so I didn't ask this then, but at the time I was going to ask. Say you only had one operator, then you only really have one parameter there, right?
Yeah.
G and lambda is kind of a fake. It's really, there's a scale for every operator. And then the issue is, are you at large energies or small energies compared to that scale?
It's not fake. It's still G and lambda. What you do is when you
everything cares about the ratio only. Right?
Exactly. It's only the ratio.
Only that one number that matters.
You can, however, you can always use the EFT if you push lambda to a large value and increase G to a large value. Of course, then you are in a regime where you only have strongly coupled theories living. Okay?
The reason I'm not resisting that is that, so if we, instead of writing this, we had written 1 over m squared, and we never talked about g.
But this is not, I don't think this is a right representation.
If we only have one operator, then that's exactly the same thing, right?
Then you don't have
the content is, if you have more than one operator, then you're saying that, simply if I have n operators, rather than talk about n coefficients, I'm going to have to talk about n plus 1, because I'm thinking of the common factor. But for one operator, that's irrelevant, right?
No, you fix the coupling itself that you want to match onto the UV theory, basically, by setting it to 1, which is okay. I mean, it's a fairly large coupling still.
If I understand you correctly, you're saying that if I had that Lorentzian with that one operator, you're saying that I have a way of independently getting a prediction for G and lambda. And I would say that all physics depends on the ratio, and that's it.
Yeah, me too.
So then, let's just talk about the ratio.
Sure.
And then, we'll call it M.
Yeah, but M is not a physical scale anymore. That's the point.
M is you
basically reduce two variables to one variable. You can do this. You can redefine it by setting, for example, G to 1. Then it would be the physical scale. You can leave this floating. Then if 1 over M is not the physical scale anymore, the new physics scale would still be G divided by lambda.
I think the point is just say there's the W mass and there's G for V, and that the W mass being new particles.
So if you have
if you get the high enough scales, you'll see a resonance, and there is a use in decoupling.
So I can parse those words because you're saying if I have the UV theory, I can distinguish a mass from the effective coupling. But what he's saying is I've got the Fermi theory, I've got the Fermi coupling, but I can somehow pick apart the W mass.
I think that's why there's a red line, right? Because then at that point you'll start seeing the new physics.
Going back to the original question, the problem with these Galilean models is that their UV completion scale is way below the energy of the LHC, and so what I'm hoping you're going to get to is explaining how you make contact with the LHC.
Then you cannot. Of course, this is clear. If you integrate out the degrees of freedom, if the UV completion is below the kinetic cutoff of the LHC, then you are not allowed to use the EFT approach. This is to give an interpretation of this measurement.
But what do you do? They don't have an alternative to the EFT.
No, we can have a look at the. So in this case. In this case, we have a look at the leading order contributions, the conformal coupling and the disformal coupling. You see, for example, if you build this in, that you have, because the dimensionality is so high and the dependence on the partial derivatives, therefore on the momentum dependence of these operators is extremely high, you get an enhancement, a tremendous enhancement actually, in the tails of the transverse.
I'm asking a really dumb question here. So go back to the Lagrangian. So this L1 d5 d5 t mu. So that's an Lagrangian which is defined up to energy. How large the energy? What's the cutoff?
A priori, I don't set what the cutoff is. The EFT basically sets a limit on the operator. Whether I can use it to set a limit on a UV theory depends on what UV theory I want to limit. It's only a language of taking information from a low scale to the high scale. I think this discussion has been going on for the Higgs part for a very long time and still goes on.
My understanding of the Galilean people, when they sell their theory, they say that if you try to take the theory above something less than the millivolt scale, that they have a unitarity problem. They don't know how to calculate it.
Since you don't have a UV complete theory for gravity, I don't know, or at this level, I don't know how you set this basically. It depends on your model that gives rise to these kind of interactions. So
the way that they do is that they say that they power cap with Milovni theory and they ask, at what point do I lose control of the, my calculations? And there's a self-consistent, you know, power capping answer.
That's right, yes.
And it's a very low scale.
Yeah.
So then, they say, I don't know how to...
Then you cannot use it for Galilean models potentially. This is true.
But what sample do you use?
So M4, I will set there will be a set of limit for these operators using differential distributions from the LHC. So as you can see here, for example, 2 phi plus jet. So if you basically have a process where you have one jet going in one direction and two of the phi's going into the other direction, you can see that the transverse, the PT miss distribution is extremely enhanced for large momenta. And if you, for example, put in, you can discriminate this actually from a scalar dark matter partner. Everybody is these days using simplified models for scalar dark matter partners. You can put this in. And in the end, you can see that you can even discriminate between these different scenarios. Now, existing limits for example, disformal couplings have been derived from cooling temperatures of supernovae. This gives you the strongest bound here of 92 GeV. But usually, these low energy constraints are extremely weak just because these interactions are protected by the momentum transfer. If you have a small momentum transfer, the contribution is small. Now, the ideal environment, and we actually want to set a limit on 1 ohm over m to the power of 4 in an agnostic way, right? You put this into your theory, you make a measurement for this Wilson coefficient, and then it's the task of the theorist, basically, to take this limit and trace it back to the UV theory in one way or another.
So what are the rules? So because I think you introduced this topic, but I missed the introduction. So this is the idea is that there's a scalar field, it's very light, and yeah. We just take all possible interactions with the scalar field, or is there some rule as to which one you take?
Yeah, so this is the Hondesky theory, basically, where you have one scalar field coupling to gravity with equations of motion of the second order.
Right. So the motivation there, if I understand it correctly, is that the proposition is that if I look at the solutions to the classical equations, they've been designed so that the classical equations only have second order equations. Right?
Yeah.
But in effective theory, you don't really care.
No, this is an assumption on the theory.
So that means that there's a specific pattern of these Wilson coefficients that have been designed in at some scale. But does that play an important role in the analysis you're doing? Or if I just said I just have some random scalar field and I put down all possible interactions.
For the analysis itself, this would be added up in an incoherent way because you get a different multiplicity of phi's here. With 2 phi's, you basically have a distribution for actually one operator here only. There's no VEF, right? This particle has not a VEF or anything like that. So
derivatives help you, right? If you were like 5 to the 4 times the standard model operator,
no. We did this. We actually did include the higher dimension and higher order operators here, all of them as well, and had a look at those. And we took to find basically nonlinearities in the distributions. This is all in the paper. I didn't want, because it's already quite a lot of material. So, and you see that the contributions are extremely small, so it's very difficult to see nonlinearities in this approach. What we set here is an, what I set here in this, on these slides is a limit on the leading order operators, just these two, using these differential distributions. And as you can see here, the LHC can, because the conformal coupling couples, so the conformal operator is proportional to the mass of the particle produced. This would be most sensitive in top associated production. These things have to be radiated off from, just due to the conformal anomaly, these have to be radiated off from the top with couples proportional to the mass of the top quark. Whereas the disformal couplings, they don't have this. They don't want to couple to light stuff, but energetic stuff. So you have basically a higher sensitivity in jet-associated production at the LHC. And now you can set a limit from this measurement alone on the scale M, which is significantly higher than all of the low-energy measurements before. What you make of it in terms of your UV model, you have underlying that gives basically rise in the end to your dark energy. This is a different question.
So what's the disformal coupling? I missed that.
Sorry? This?
The disformal coupling, what is that?
The disformal coupling is just this one. So you have the energy momentum tensor coupled to the field, and you get this from here. and you have the conformal coupling from here. So,
so if I'm adventurous enough to put these two things together, joined by the phi ends, and do a loop, which is of course not defined very well, right? But with some UV scale to the blah blah to power and then TBU square, right? Because we probably if I just say naively that the lambda would be this kind of the same scale as M. Then it probably be even more sensitive to the stem of contact of the
person. Yes. That's true. Okay. Yeah. All right. Another thing you can have is if you have a broken shift symmetry, you have basically these operators C10, which would just lead to potentially displaced vertices. Assuming the mass of phi is large enough to decay, you would then have at the LHC even higher sensitivity because you can have displaced vertices. You can pop out the whole framework that has been devised for long-lived dark sectors, basically, and are being looked for. Hidden valleys and so on at the LHC, and you can then probe even higher scales, assuming that the particle can decay and the lifetime is short enough to not only be observed as missing energy, but to be detected within the detector. So this is just another example of an area where effective field theories as being used at the LHC can help to potentially infer information on or limit basically new physics, for example, in models thought of in cosmology. It has been discussed in great detail that the EFT is not valid if the propagating degrees of freedom are actually too light. And then, of course, people went on to talk about simplified models. Now, this was used in this the first step to cross-correlate information across different measurements, across different detectors, was using an EFT framework. Now you have basically direct detection experiments, indirect detection experiments, and collider searches. And the momentum transfer for indirect detection and direct detection is usually small. At the collider, it's not small. So using just one framework here to try to capture all of these measurements is potentially bound to be extremely limited or even fail. So what people did then was not using the effective field theory framework, but using simplified models to account for potential degrees of freedom that can be resolved at the LHC, which might not be resolved at direct and indirect detection experiments. So you have basically different paths here, right? If you, for example, want to produce WIMPs, two WIMPs in the final state, and you recoil them against a hard jet, then this vertex can be resolved in different ways. For example, you could have a heavy resonance, actually, that is a mediator between the visible sector and the dark sector. However, the top quark might couple to this resonance, and you might resolve the top quark mass in this loop. So you would have this kind of effective theory. You could also have the other way around, a fairly light mediator, but maybe a new physics sector that cannot be resolved here in this loop. So you basically have then the mediator phi here, and you calculate this with an effective coupling. Or it could be the case that you have a light mediator that connects the visible and dark sector, also coupling to the top quark potentially, which can be resolved in the loop.
Let's do oversimplified models, where the mediator is the stem model particle, let's say.
Perfect.
X, Z, or gamma.
Yeah.
A gamma is probably not very good for the LHC. The gates on the photon shell decay is probably good. I have a question about the Z mediator, right? So if I, is there any sensitivity for LHC to talking to dark matter to the Z?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, yeah. Not only at the LHC. I mean, we already said invisible decays, for example, of the Z.
Oh,
that
will make it larger than the.
Yeah,
if you have 5 GeV,
yeah.
So the Z doesn't decay.
Yeah, there is sensitivity. It's even for the Higgs. There is, for example, people looked into Higgs decaying.
Is that true that there is a sensitivity to the dark matter?
since the coupling
is... I said like 50 GB dark matter and I coupled to this. Is it possible to push it up on the sort of the invisible decays of the zillions as a background? Because I doubt.
No, there's a VBF topology. People had a look at the VBF topology. For it's difficult, but you, I mean, they say it's sensitive. For example, Higgs-Portal models have this all the time, right? You can have, for example, either inert Higgs-Portal model, or you have basically a dark matter candidate, where the additional scalar kind of.
As far as I know, so far, the only launch of the Higgs is the dark matter assets. Right? If you just have offshore Higgs, I don't think you have much sensitivity.
That's true, because it's a very narrow resonance. The question is now how you want to embed this in your theory. Do you have an additional resonance which mediates this, or it's only the Higgs boson and nothing else? You just write basically a dark matter particle and you go...
My oversimplified model is a chi coupled to the Z over the axial vector coupling with a small coefficient.
Yeah.
Let's say, what's the LHC sensitivity to the small coefficient? I don't know.
The problem is that you have a very narrow resonance, so you're highly off-shell for the Higgs boson if the mass...
I'm talking about the Z.
And the Z is a bit better because it's broader, right? So you have a better
because
chance.
Because you're sensitive, it doesn't mean that you can disentangle it from Z to a minimum bar.
I know that maybe the answer as to what the size of the coupling I can put in, right?
10% error of Z to minimum bar.
Of Z to
a minimum bar.
Right.
So, yeah.
But you don't have it really when you set to invisible measurement of those, because that's another question I ask.
But people look into this. People do it, right? You have, usually you, what you want is we want to have the DiJet topology. So you basically have the weak boson fusion topology, where you have the Z boson, you have two jets, central region is completely, is very clean.
So that hasn't been done?
No, but it will be done for 14 TeV or 13 TeV, yeah. Well, this is the, yeah. And then, of course, what you can do is you can now have a look at these different contributions. Here, for example, for a mediator, you have a constraint here not to overclose the universe. You have indirect detection experiments for the scalar. And you will see that collider limits are actually complementary to this. So you can probe a different parameter region using collider limits, even more so if you have a CP odd scalar as a mediator, where direct detection experiments are velocity suppressed, so you would have to rely on indirect detection experiments like Fermilat. And of course, these limits are potentially weak compared to collider experiments, depending, of course, on the mass of the mediator and the dark matter particle itself. You can do this for 100 TeV as well, and here it's even a bit more striking, particularly for the CP odd scalars down there. And the XE vectors, where we have spin-dependent dark matter detection. Not so much for vector mediators here. The direct detection experiments seem to outperform even a 100 TeV machine. But there is some complementary information you can obtain in these kind of experiments using now these simplified models. So the whole talk basically was mostly focused on the was basically aiming to show the different languages that are being used to infer information from one scale to the other. We talked about Kappa framework, we talked about the EFT framework, the simplified model framework, and potential UV completions. Now, the biggest thing, I think, during the shutdown phase of the LHC was, at least most discussed, was the paper and the proposal by Kaola and Melnikov to actually limit the total Higgs width in a model-independent way in off-shell measurements. This was picked up by the Johns Hopkins group from CMS. They built this in and took by surprise the whole high-energy physics community by showing this analysis that has only been proposed a few weeks before, two, 3 weeks before, by Kaola and Melnikov. So Atlas was surprised, the theorists were surprised, everybody was surprised. This made a huge hullabaloo on the blogs, Quantum Diaries, Spectacular CMS, and so on, Atlas blogs, John Butterworth in The Guardian, and so on. So the point is, if your competition, John Butterworth and Atlas, praises your work, can either mean you have done a great job or something is fishy, right? So, and in this case, I think it's probably both. So first of all, it's of course great that they have done this analysis so extremely fast, but the overall interpretation was unfortunately not model independent as claimed. So what they are actually doing is The on-shell cross-section scales like the coupling, production coupling squared times the decay coupling squared divided by the total width, as we discussed before. The off-shell coupling, however, does not have the total width piece. It only scales like the production coupling times the decay coupling. So what the proposal was is you measure this combination of couplings in the off-shell region. You plug it in into the on-shell region. And because you know the number of events and the cross-section in this region, you can set an indirect limit on the total width. Very nice, and works also smoothly if you actually can relate this coupling region to this coupling region. As soon as this relation breaks down, it doesn't work anymore. And this was basically underappreciated, I would say, in the first publications. So what, however, CNS still claims and shows is that the total width is basically smaller than 4.2 times the standard model width. The standard model width is extremely small, right? 4 MeV roughly. A measurement, if it was model independent of such a precision, would be outstanding and would never have been thought of being able to achieve at a Hadron collider, would not even be achievable probably or would be very difficult to achieve.
There is still information here because it tells you how much they need to improve to get to the standard model, right?
That's right, but I will exactly tell you how much information is there. So this is exactly the point. Because the language you are using, the answer you get from your measurement depends crucially on the language you are using to ask the question. And this is basically what I'm alluding to here. So this measurement, if this was true in a model independent way, this would be great. Still, 4.2 is far away, but for a collider, for a Hadron collider, this is outstanding. And this also gave rise to the many block entries and so on. However, as I said, if this relation breaks down, and it's actually easy to break it, then the whole thing doesn't work out anymore. Now we can ask ourselves, going into one language, basically using the Kappa framework, the EFT framework, a simplified model framework, or the full model itself, how much information does give me this measurement by itself? For example, in the Kappa framework, everything works out perfectly. In the Kappa framework, I have a global rescaling of on-shell and off-shell coupling. They are directly related. I measure the off-shell part, plug it in into the on-shell part. Perfect. EFT framework, it works as well, assuming there are no flat directions. So for example, if you only had one operator, the off-shell coupling of the effective theory and the on-shell coupling in the effective theory and the measurement are directly related. Yes, you can have RGE running and these kind of things, but this is calculable. This is nothing new, basically. Now, within your model framework, you have a direct relation between the off-shell and the on-shell part. However, in simplified models, the whole thing breaks. You can, for example, and we showed this, have corrections. You can have large contributions in the on-shell part for light resonances, for example, and you can have zero contribution in the on-shell part. If you now measure the coupling in the off-shell part, plug it in, you get an arbitrarily small width. So you can an accidentally small width in your limit. So you over-constrain the width of the whole thing. If you have, for example, a Higgs portal model that contributes mostly to the on-shell part, whereas not to the off-shell part. You can even have, and this was also shown by Heather Logan, basically have new resonances that are below the cutoff scale here, basically living in this white area here, not showing up in the off-shell part, but contributing to the on-shell part. These kind of things can happen, and this, of course, breaks directly your limit on the total width. So if people ask you, is the Higgs width basically limited to 4.2 times the standard model width? Well, it depends on the question you are asking. Then people say, okay, after these kind of loopholes were shown, people were saying, we measure within the standard model. This is also a nonsensical statement, because if you are in a full theory, if you completely specify your theory, the width is not a free parameter of your theory. It's a result of the open branching ratios and the couplings you have chosen. So it's even not interesting to ask for the width in a well-defined, fully specified theory.
So assuming that it's just that one, which gets, of course, calculated gamma and so on, with this future runs get down from 4 to 1?
Yeah, not 1. I think the prediction is not 1.
Not 1.
No, it's not 1. it's
because that would
two to three or something.
Test of consistency.
Yeah.
So in other words, you don't quite see the off-shell mediated production to the level you want, right?
Yeah, of course. I think a global fit is always doing better than these one-shot measurements, basically, because you have. In a global fit, you can take into account basically how you are already now down to something like 20% or so invisible branching ratio of the Higgs boson. So this is much, much better than what can be achieved in this measurement. But the nice part would have been if this had been model independent. In a global fit, you make also a specification. You again choose your language to ask the question. Whereas if this had been really model independent, this would have been a big thing. Well, now CNS pulled back to some degree, and also ATLAS and so on, of course. But what you can read now in these publications is assuming no new particles in the loop. But if you assume, and this is again a problem of the fact that you have to realize that the model assumptions directly impact on the information you get out of the measurement. If you make the assumption that there are no new particles in the loop, then actually you only have the freedom to vary your coupling in the for the gauge bosons. And this has been measured extremely precisely already at lab. So assuming no new particles in the loop will lead to the fact that the LHC will never outperform the lab measurements. And already now we have a much, much better total width limit from lab measurements where we have actually probed the Higgs boson constantly off shell without knowing. And you get basically a much, much more narrow limit than the LHC will ever achieve. So this is just to exemplify that the question you are asking and the language you are using is actually extremely crucial. So I don't know. I have too much material, I think. Way too much material. So I think I could go on another hour, basically. So. At the LHC, we have a lot of, now increasing the energy basically after run 2 to run 1 to run 2 leads to basically a significant increase of energy, maybe potentially the only one we will observe in our lifetime potentially, since at least with a factor of 2. So we should really make sure we make the most of this increase of energy and most of the data that is being provided with large momentum transfer at the high energy frontier. And this is just a brief overview of what kind of processes could be relevant for this and where basically the energy pays off. Higgs to BB bar can only be measured with large transverse momentum. Off-shell measurements make use of this. HC final states, where you have gluon-induced production and so on. TT bar Higgs, one of the most important couplings. And so on and so on. So basically, I would have liked to focus on a little bit on these three, but I don't think I have the time to go through here. The Higgs to BB bar case was promoted early on by Butterworth, Davison, and Rubin, and you basically have here a direct indication. People thought this final state would never be useful at the LHC, because this was actually a nice final state to probe at Tevatron, where you have UU bar plenty in the initial state. However, the PDF suppression at the LHC led to the fact. That people have thought of this final state to be irrelevant. But you can actually dig out this final state by requiring the Higgs boson to be boosted transverse to the beam axis after requesting the Z boson to have a transverse momentum of something like 200 GeV in PT. And then you get nice peaks for the Higgs boson next to a gauge boson. And you can then use a data-driven approach, because you know the height of the gauge boson and the coupling strength of the gauge boson to quarks. You can infer in a model in a data-driven way the coupling strength of the Higgs boson itself. The other thing would be Higgs top couplings. Higgs top, the only way of probing the Higgs top coupling directly, not in a loop and so on, would be the TTH final state. The Higgs, of course, cannot decay into top quarks, so we have to produce an association with the top quark, and TTH gives you the largest production cross section. At 8 TeV, already the strongest limit was set in Higgs to BB bar by ATLAS, something like signal strength of roughly 3.4 times. Of the standard model prediction. This is, to be honest, not extremely good, because the story was always TTH was completely overrated in the initial days of ATLAS. After in 1999, it was one of the, and maybe the discovery channel for a light Higgs boson at the LHC. After taking a more careful approach, analyzing actually this final state, people find that signal over background was 1 over 9, and after 30 inverse femtobound, only S over square root B of 2.2. The killer here is S over B of 1 over 9, because this means you need to know the backgrounds to more than 10% accuracy to say anything. And this, for these highly complicated backgrounds, is very, very difficult to achieve even today. So the same story as for BDRS can be done in the TTH final state, where you basically separate the combinatorial issues by trying to reconstruct the Higgs on one side and the top on the other side. And then you can, by including other phase-based regions as well, you can basically reconstruct this final state and separate signal from background. So you improve S over B, and it suddenly becomes accessible. So let me maybe just finish by talking about Dihiggs. Dihiggs is quite important at the LHC as well. And of course, we want to know the underlying mechanism of electric symmetry breaking. So what we want to actually access is the Higgs self-coupling, which enters directly the electric symmetry breaking potential. And however, there are, of course, in an EFT framework, other contributions to two Higgs final states as well. Unfortunately, the LHC is almost our best shot for it. If you have a look at other colliders, for example, the ILC, only if you get a 1 TeV ILC, you get to the sensitivity estimated for the LHC. So even an ILC with only 500 GeV is not buying us too much in measuring this, one of the maybe the most important coupling left to measure for the Higgs sector. So again, we have to make the most of the LHC, the collider we have, and potentially even outperforms future collider. The problem, however, is to measure two Higgs bosons in the final state, you can produce them in different ways, right? First of all, if you do the low energy effective theory expansion, you can produce them basically by having a Higgs boson in the S channel, splitting to two Higgs bosons. Or you can produce it directly, effectively, by coupling it to the gluons. And as you can see here, they come with different signs. So they destructively interfere with each other, which means if I increase, and what's important is this part dominates. So if I increase lambda, the overall cross-section goes down. So limiting larger Higgs self-couplings is increasingly difficult at the LHC in this production mechanism. Now, it's a 2-to-2 process, and you want to reconstruct shapeless resonances in the final state, and this is highly, highly difficult. It's only a scalar, two scalars in the final state that decay preferably to BB bar, basically, so very difficult to see them at the LHC. What you actually want is, and you have a much better reconstruction efficiency and purity of the final state if you go to large transverse momentum for the individual Higgs bosons, but you pay it with a huge price, because the propagator here scales with 1 over mh squared. So if I increase the invariant mass of the two Higgs final state, I suppress this diagram or this contribution here over this contribution. And therefore, this is what I want to measure, right? Here, no Higgs self-coupling is involved in this process. So I want to have sensitivity here, but for large transverse momenta of the Higgs boson, which I need to reconstruct, I unfortunately have reduced sensitivity with respect to the self-coupling, and this is what you can see here. For large transverse momentum, the varying self-coupling gives only a small effect. Okay, this is a log plot, so it's still probably visible. But this is actually where you want to sit to have good measurements for the Higgs self-coupling. Now, just a brief overview of the different channels that have been discussed. BB bar gamma gamma, BB bar tau tau, BB bar WW, four Bs. BB bar gamma gamma, of course, is statistics limited, extremely small number of events, only 30 events. Are left after 3,000 inverse femtobarn, so this is an extremely small channel after reconstruction. BB tau tau has a larger branching ratio, but backgrounds for tops are large. You can use MT2 to reduce these backgrounds. BBWW looks exactly like tops, so this is also very difficult to get a grip on. And then 4Bs have been discussed as well, but they are plagued by large uncertainties from QCD. So overall, at the LHC, it will be very, very difficult to measure this coupling, but it's the best shot we have. Now you could think of, okay, so we just discussed here the gluon fusion production. Maybe you look at the second largest production mechanism PP to Higgs, Higgs, Jet, Jet, the VBF contribution. And what you can see here, this scales very strongly with the Higgs self-coupling. And of course, you want this. You want the cross-section to scale very strongly with the self-coupling. The cross-section goes significantly down for large self-couplings. The problem here is, and people have not studied this in detail, only in recent years this was studied, there are other contributions, right? It's not only, it's the VBF part, which also gives you self-interaction, but it's also the gluon fusion part. And the gluon fusion part, again, dominates over the VBF part. You don't have the benefit of requiring mini-jet vetos and all these kind of clean things in the central part of your detector, because you need to have one Higgs decaying to bottom quarks. So there's a lot of hadronic activity also in the central part of your detector. And if you do the full analysis, for example, this contribution has only been calculated to leading order, actually, by us in 2013 for the first time. People usually only used effective field theory operators to have an estimate for this process. In the finite top mass approach, this hasn't even been calculated until then. And you see that is quite a crucial contribution to take into account. In the end, what you see is that you can actually limit the VBHH coupling, but the self-coupling sensitivity is basically not present in this final state. To conclude then, the last process you could think of, this is probably the most active at the LHC you can probe in the Higgs sector, TTHH. The total cross-section is only one femtobarn before decays, so you will have to, but the backgrounds are extremely small as well. You will have to include some B tagging, and you have to probably look into semi-leptonic top decays. We did that. But the nice part is here, actually, the cross-section goes up for larger self-couplings. So you could imagine to set a limit for smaller self-couplings in gluon fusion and use this channel to set a limit on larger self-couplings. This is a nice complementarity. So we did this study, and what we found in the end, also with an extremely small signal sample of only 13 to 22 signal events, depending on the number of B-tags you put in, with 3,000 inverse femtobarn, you might be able to limit at the end of the runtime of the LHC the self-coupling to 2.5 times lambda self-coupling. These limits are not very good, of course, because lots of BSM models would give much smaller contributions to the self-coupling itself. But that's the situation we have at the moment. Okay, so I will use this. Basically, we have several observations in this talk I tried to point out. The method chosen to communicate the information impacts on the feedback you get from the experiment and in your interpretation of the UV scale physics, right? If you use if you basically use Kappa framework, EFT framework, simplified models, or actually a full framework, and you do a global fit or something like that, this gives you a different level of information. And there's, of course, always a trade-off to be made between precision and simplicity of the language you are using. On the other hand, Higgs phenomenology will profit and benefit in the coming years tremendously from the increase of center of mass energy from 7 and 8 TeV to 13 and 14 TeV. What I would have liked to talk about, but of course this is not possible anymore, is that there's actually a new way of analyzing data. This matrix element inspired method that is dubbed shower deconstruction that combines exactly these two features, that basically is a hypothesis testing approach exploiting particularly exclusive phase space region of your final state. So this is being developed and pretty close. I mean, this is being developed and already being used in Atlas and CMS, and it performs extremely well. Okay, so let me just flip through the whole thing here. So to summarize, basically, this was the point is, I hope actually that we are able to cure HEP and ourselves a little bit from the Big Mac blues. There's actually a lot of interesting physics at the moment beyond and within the Higgs sector. Diphoton excess we have searches for top partners at the LHC. Gravitational waves were a great thing to see. Of course, there will be future Euclid large-scale surveys, and since the Higgs has been discovered, maybe we are in the position now to establish non-perturbative effects even of the SU2 gauge group, maybe by measuring sphalerons or seeing sphalerons at either the LHC or maybe cosmic rays, or even at ice cube, these kind of this kind of experiments. So basically, the cross-correlation of theories from different angles, I think, is of crucial importance. And I think Parameter is here at a great position because you have this expertise across all these fields to make your big impact. So exciting times ahead. Thanks.
Enhancements of the
sphalerons, exactly. Yeah. So there was a recent calculation also by Henry Tai and collaborators, where they used a periodicity of the transcendence potential. So you use this Bloch wave function, and they predict an enhancement of the production cross section to an extent you can even potentially produce it at the LHC. You can also set limits in ice loop and so on.
How old was that paper, the Henry Tai paper?
Not old. 1 year, maybe, two.
Because he had an earlier version of the same idea, those days the argument was that so using a Bloch wave function is like using a momentum eigenstate in a lattice.
It's exact solid state argument.
But in field theory, normally the cluster decomposition tells you should be in a field eigenstate, not in a momentum eigenstate field. So then the argument against him in his earlier version, like 10 years ago, was, so does that mean that he's giving up a cluster decomposition?
Yeah, I think it's still highly disputed. It's exactly what you say, basically. And you can, if you could calculate it in a field theoretical framework, basically, then you would be better off using only a quantum mechanical analogy. It's probably not the best thing to do, but this is basically just an analogy. And you can then project what cross sections you would expect. And you can set a limit if this analogy would hold.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so there's no movement on that.
Nah, this would be interesting to do.
we had a lot of questions during the talk, so let's thank Michael again.